This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Again, on election day, the soothing music of Alan Jackson.
It's painted red.
Because we care.
It's 18 feet from the bow of the stern light. Second hand from a dealer in Atlanta.
Singing about a boat.
I rode up with Daddy when he went there to get her. Put on a shine, put on a motor. Built out of love, made for the water.
He sings about the clutch. About the clutch here in a few minutes. But I got no time for that. Joining me is Chris Woodbridge, editor and publisher of the Marine Corps Gazette, publisher of Leatherneck, and a retired Marine colonel. Where were you? Where did you grow up, Woody?
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. Was there till I was about 17 years old, and then after that moved around a little bit and wound up at college upstate New York.
All right, so let's tell everybody about Brooklyn, known as what, Flatbush?
There's a lot of different subdivisions or neighborhoods within Brooklyn that have names. Flatbush is one of those, but that was Flatbush was pretty far from where I grew up. I grew up in an area called Bay Ridge. Bay Ridge is kind of the southern part of Brooklyn. It's right along the Brooklyn waterfront, out through where the Verrazano Bridge takes you over to Staten Island and goes throughout that waterfront area along the Narrows and the East River.
Okay, so most people when they think of New York City, right? They have a visual image of Manhattan, all right? So relative to Manhattan, tell everybody where Brooklyn is.
Okay, if Manhattan Island, and especially the southern tip where all the really the skyscrapers are, where Ground Zero is, Wall Street, that area, if that's 12 o'clock on the clock face,
okay.
where I lived in Brooklyn was kind of down by about 4:30, 5 o'clock, and so there's a lot of different ways to get from point A to point B, subway, driving, walking, what have you. All of them take a lot of time and are really congested.
Tell me about growing up in the greater New York City area. What was that like? First of all, my favorite city on the planet, New York City. I love it because you don't need a car. There's great food. There's incredible things to see in history. The Yankees play at the north end of Manhattan. Mm-hmm. Love that.
Yep.
And there's just kind of a everybody calls it a vibe that goes with New York City, and there certainly is that. But it goes. But I love the history of it from Wall Street. And learning about why they called it Wall Street, and then everything there. As a New Yorker, what's your favorite part? What was your favorite part of as you look back growing up in New York City?
So growing up back in the 70s, it was a very different different city back then.
Explain to everybody how different it was.
Well, first of all, wasn't as crowded as it is now. New York City today is as populated as it has ever been in the history of the United States. So it was a little less crowded back then, but there was actually a lot more crime back in the 70s.
Right.
The whole country was in a recession. And, it hit New York City as well. So a lot of unemployment, a lot of public services not being there. The old joke is back then, most of the streetlights, like one in every 3 to 4 streetlights were out and weren't getting repaired. A lot of streets were darker than they would be at night, and not surprisingly, you had more crime because of that. Also had some infrastructure problems. There was a series of blackouts back in the 70s that were really pretty devastating. Not so much the effects of losing power, but what people start doing to each other when they do lose power. So, you know, looting and, you know, rioting, crime like that. So it was kind of a sporty place to grow up and be a, you know, preteen and teenager, you know, run around, on the streets looking for things to do or staying out, you know, trying to stay out of trouble, but, and not necessarily, succeeding. It was also a great place to grow up. The one thing I'll say is New York is a great big, mosaic of neighborhoods. And so, you know, everybody learns their neighborhood, kind of like a small town. You know, that may be a few city blocks square. And then there are a lot of people who just don't venture into other neighborhoods if they don't have to. It's not quite the melting pot that people, you know, would paint it to be. There's a lot of small neighborhoods and a lot of people, you know, congregate and kind of associate with the folks in that neighborhood. If you're not from that neighborhood, then you're an outsider. You're right. You don't really need to drive anywhere. And yet many people do. As I said, things are really crowded, congested. Good luck finding a parking spot. my first driving experiences were moving and parking the car for my old man because he didn't want to. You know, you got to get up early in the morning to move the car because they have what are called alternate side of the street parking rules. So basically, every 2 days you got to move your car from one side of the street to the other so the Department of Sanitation can clean that side of the street. Pick up trash and all that sort of stuff.
And good luck. Good luck finding a spot at 4 a.m.
Exactly. And so you wind up double parking a car. Somebody's got to sit in it. And when you're the kid with the new learner's permit or the gut license, that becomes part of your job. You know, and pick me up a carton of smokes on your way back. So.
Hey, that's back in the day when we used to do stuff like that and not think twice about it. That's before we wore seatbelts. What are these seatbelt things for, and why do they keep putting them in the car?
Yeah, you didn't have that in the old Buick. You didn't need it.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, so, okay, so favorite place to eat in New York City?
Wow.
Tough
I would tell that, that's, I mean, that's really tough, but... you know, just in terms of kind of old school family history places we used to go. This is not a paid advertisement either. I don't get anything from these folks, but there's a very old American style Chinese restaurant down in Chinatown in Manhattan called Wohop, Wohop. It's been there since about 1930, and I think it's the same pot of soup that's been cooking the whole time. and it's just really, really amazing. You know, pretty inexpensive, huge portions, and it's not what the hipsters would think of as authentic Chinese food. It's very much, you know, Chinese, you know, American style Chinese food. But the place is just a landmark for you know, a lot of New Yorkers. Went there when they were kids, got taken there for, you know, for special occasions by the family, and this goes all the way back to when my mom was a girl. You know, her mom used to work down in the financial district in Manhattan, which is right nearby, and she'd take her to dinner there. This is back in the, you know, the early to mid 30s. So yeah, I've been going there a lot. There's the famous Ray's Pizza, the original Ray's, which is on 11th Street over on between 6th and 7th Avenue. That's the finest pizza you're going to get on the planet. It's so good. There are many other Ray's pizzas that have kind of spun off of that, but that's the original Ray's, or that's the Ray's of my my high school days. And gosh, what else? Some of it kind of just depends what you want to eat and you know, what you've you know, what you're in the mood for. Because I mean, there is you got to kind of work hard in the city to find a bad meal.
You know what? That's the truth. I love going down to Little Italy.
Yeah.
It's a throwback place, love going down there. But you're right. You got to work to find a bad meal in New York City because it is the coin of the realm, right? If you can't make it good, then you're going to be out of business pretty quick. So it's I don't care if you're looking for cheesecake, Chinese food, hot dogs, or Philly cheesesteaks. You're gonna. In fact, you know what's one of the great changes in Major League Baseball is the food that you get at a stadium. I had one of the best Philly cheesesteaks I've ever had in my life in Yankee Stadium. Yeah, like we walked by.
That's
it was
not
like,
intuitive.
Yeah, like what was that smell? I don't know, but it's coming from over there. Go get whatever they're making. Oh my God, it fed two people, right? And it was awesome. It was awesome. I think we ate three of them during the course of the game. It was great. All right, let's talk about this month's Gazette, November. Well, first of all, give me your thoughts on Election Day. I always begin the show on Election Day. It's, you know, Election Day is Memorial Day disguised. That right that not everybody around the world has been purchased and payments made with the lives of Americans, with the body parts of Americans, with the sanity of Americans throughout our history. And, you won the ovarian lottery to be American. It's your duty to go vote. And today's the day we truly remember those who preserved that right. I'm curious, your thoughts. You have any thoughts?
I couldn't agree with you more. It's, it is such a defining feature of our democracy. It is the definition of our democracy. And I absolutely encourage everybody to use that right that's been purchased for them in blood and treasure, and it almost doesn't matter how it goes. You know, I mean, there's going to be an outcome, and because it's democracy, somebody's going to be happy and somebody's not going to be happy, and it's more important, I think, the process and what comes after the process that defines us as a nation. It's the process of people participating and then accepting the results after the elections are complete. Respecting the process and respecting the results. And then getting on with the business of their lives and the business of running the country. That's what makes us different. And, you know, we've all, served, have been in places where, you know, having free and democratic elections were a major milestone in the history of those countries, be it Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Liberia, other places. Having a process, we discover on the ground is really only kind of half the battle. You have the process, but then how do people view and accept the results of the process? And when the results of the process are respected, and the rule of law governs how things move on, then you've one step closer to an actual functioning, democratic system of government. However, when the results are, immediately, challenged, invalidated, denigrated, and a resistance movement forms, then you're going down the wrong road at that point, and the respect or the power or the value of the rule of law has been lost at that point. So I think we have the opportunity to be participating in that and to be the best example, or at least the least worst form of government that anybody's got on the planet.
You know, right.
The only reason we're great is because everybody else's is worse.
You know what? Churchill said about that, right?
Yes.
It's the worst form of government.
Democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others.
Yeah, save all others. Okay, here's a pop quiz for you. The United States ranks where in terms of world population?
oh gosh, I want to say we're pretty far down the list. I want to say we're like sixth or eighth. I'm guessing.
You know what? I did that yesterday. We're third.
Third, really?
Yeah.
I wouldn't have put us that high.
Neither would I. I said, who knew? But obviously China, India right behind China.
Yep.
The United States, third in world population, which is pretty amazing, given our standard of living. 323. Yep. I want to say the next is 250, and I can't even, that's Indonesia. Indonesia, Brazil.
Okay.
So interesting. I'm like you. Off the top of my head, I would have said, yeah, there's other countries that are bigger than we are. But I was actually surprised about that. Let's talk about the November issue. Now that we talked about elections, what's the theme in November?
So the November Gazette obviously is our birthday month issue, 243rd birth of the Corps, and. So annually we'll dedicate a fair amount of the magazine's focus to leadership and some history as well. This month we did something a little different. It's not inconsistent with those themes, but for the first time we've collaborated with the staff, the CO and the staff at the basic school here at Quantico, and there's a focus area, a series of articles about the basic school, and it's I call it going back to the beginning, because for all officers essentially it is the beginning of your career in the Marine Corps, your period of service in the Marine Corps, and it's the common starting point for all of those Marine leaders, whether that period of service lasts, 5 years or 35 years, it all starts at TBS. And so, after talking with, Colonel Dave Everly, who's the CO out there, and, General Cal Worth, Brigadier General Calvin Worth, who's the CG of Training Command, the basic school's higher headquarters, we thought it was a good opportunity to use the focus on esprit and history and leadership in November to really get kind of a current view of what the basic school is and how it's functioning, and the way we approach that is the staff really surrounded the subject, meaning there are articles from the CO himself, from the senior staff, there are articles from the company grade officers who are the instructors, from the sergeant major and the enlisted Marines who are the instructors and the support staff of the basic school, and then a couple of articles from second lieutenant basic school students, now graduates. So multiple perspectives on that really unique institution. That is the formative experience for all Marine officers today.
Let me ask you a question before we get into some of the different articles. And this is kind of a philosophical question. Why do you think why do you think nobody's ever emulated the basic school? Because I think it is one of the best things the Marine Corps does. We put out the highest quality first lieutenant of any branch of the service. I know it takes another 5.5 months away from their time in our operational forces. But, somebody who was really smart a long time ago in the Marine Corps said that was a good thing and it's worth the investment. And I just wondered why, especially when you see what the Navy has gone through, and I'll pick on the Navy here, what the Navy has gone through in terms of, I would say, level of professionalism and seamanship at the most basic levels in their ranks, why do you think nobody else has copied it over the course of time?
That's a great question. I know for a fact that the other services have studied it. have looked at it, have you know, visited and sent teams to you know, look at the program of instruction, look at you know, class curriculum and course content and how it's actually done. I know that, you know, we've been nothing but forthcoming with people and allow them to you know, to look at what we do. But for one reason or another, none of the other services have gone down that road. And now I'll go sort of into the opinion area, why I think it's the case. I know that they've studied it and that they've looked at it and have considered copying it. I know that because I experienced it. But now the reason I think they're not doing that is, first, all of the other services have more pronounced community divisions, meaning MOS community divisions, than the Marine Corps does. You know, there's one United States Army, but there are about five or seven tribes within the Army. The armor community, the light infantry community, mech infantry, special ops, aviation, artillery. Those are much more pronounced subcultures. Same thing on the Navy side. Really divided up sort of by warfare commands. You know, your surface Navy, subsurface Navy, aviation, special ops. Those are much more pronounced tribes or subcultures. Air Force, again, very much the same way. Fighter, bomber, transport, and then missileers, and command and control guys. So they're also tribal, more so than the Marine Corps is. It's in my opinion, that observation about tribalism or subcultures is both the chicken and the egg in this discussion of why not copy the basic school. We do not have the pronounced subcultures because we do baseline all of our officer leadership for 6 months at the basic school. And therefore we don't have this culture of subcultures, of tribes. And because we don't have the subcultures of tribes, we continue to see the value of the basic school. So it's a little bit of a circular argument there, but what that to me means is in that respect, the other services are caught in a, they're caught in a bad loop, where they, you'll never get the concurrence of all those tribes, each of whom has their own sort of basic training and officer basic training experience.
Right.
You know, they start at their schools and they build their, competence in their officer community. So again, it sustains that subculture. I think that's probably one of the main reasons that's the case. I think also, you know, there's economy of scale there. The Marine Corps is smaller. We can essentially absorb the delay in fielding newly trained officers, probably more than the larger services can. I think the last thing is it would be very hard, you know, for the other services to copy the Marine Corps without looking like they're copying the Marine Corps. And, you know, there's certainly a perception and a stigma problem with that, because there are people out there, who really look at the different services as fundamental inefficiency in our defense establishment. There are folks who, to this day do advocate for one armed force with, you know, air, naval, and ground branches. So, you know, why do you have to have, you know, three services with their own aircraft? Why can't you just have one air service? Why do you have two services that fight primarily on the ground? Well, you know, why don't you just have one ground force? There's some argument that can be made toward that consolidation whenever one of the services starts copying the other in their basic training or their force development processes.
Interesting. Because again, you think of what if you tried to do your MOS your occupational specialty. So if I'm going to become a grunt, I've got to become a grunt. I got to learn my job, and then the schoolhouse has to check all these other blocks in terms of leadership training, get my uniform, get my uniforms to fit, expose me to enlisted personnel, all that within a 10-week time frame. Seems like an awful lot. I'm surprised that you know, those MOS schools haven't been lengthened. Maybe it's like, okay, look, we can't do that, but we could absorb some of it, but we're going to have to go from 11 weeks to 20 weeks. Okay.
Right.
So I just find it odd, because I think that when you leave as a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps to go do something, it's a pretty high quality product. And I think that the things that we've done in Iraq and Afghanistan, a lot of it has rested on on second lieutenants and first lieutenants who are well healed in what's expected of them and do good things. So I
think that's been proven
right.
Multiple times, you know, regardless of the actual MOS that young officer that second first lieutenant is actually serving in, is operating in, the fundamentals, the blocking and tackling, which is primarily infantry small unit blocking and tackling, that's learned at the basic school. Everyone starts out as sort of a basic infantry lieutenant, if you want to think of it that way, for the focus of their tactical training and their field time at the basic school. That's all, you know, company level and below infantry tactics. That's paid dividends when we're talking about a convoy, a logistics sustainment convoy, whether we're talking about command and control at a radio retrans site, whether we're talking about defending an airfield or portion of an airfield in Afghanistan. This is, you know, these are skills, common skills for Marines that pay us dividends down the road.
Chris Woodbridge, my guest, editor of the Marine Corps Gazette, editor and publisher of Leatherneck Magazine, and who I just had the good fortune of going to lunch with about a week ago. So, and thank you for lunch, Woody, if I failed to do that, by the way.
Glad to have you.
Give us a couple of the articles in there. I need to disclose this. My son, actually, my oldest son, has an article in this month's Gazette. And I did not get to chop on it, which pisses me off. Yeah, like, what the hell, man? I'm a writer, what? I'm chopped liver. I don't get to take a look at it. But obviously very proud. But give us a couple. What did my son write about? What's the title of the article?
Title of the article is The Basic School Senior Instructor. And that's by Captain John McNamara and a group of other captains from what used to be called the instructor group at the basic school.
Right.
And as I said, this family of articles really sort of surrounds the topic, and they're writing from the perspective of how instructors of the instructor staff at the basic school, the officer instructor staff, and specifically how those instructors are developed and qualified, and their training and education conducted in order to be instructors. And again, this points to another extraordinary value of the basic school experience. A school is only as good as the people teaching the instructors on the staff. And so selecting the right folks to go and do that job, and then how they are trained and qualified to be instructors while they're in the job really raises that quality bar so that we are very certain that we're getting the best quality instruction for our new leaders or our new lieutenants, and that we're producing a consistent and very high quality product in that regard.
You know, Woody, I'll give you a little Marine Corps history class or question here. Who invented, right, who conceptualized the instructor education program at the basic school?
The IEP.
Who conceptualized that?
I don't know. Was that another Captain McNamara?
It was. It was. I had just such a great experience as a captain at the basic school. And I the first group chief at IOC when I went over there was let me just describe the environment. The environment was General Gray's Renaissance of Thought, Maneuver Warfare, and us scratching our heads thinking, well, how do we teach this? How did the Germans teach it? You know, we can't do what Bill Lynn says, for God's sakes. I mean, that's like insanity, right? You know, we're gonna like total free play. Like, I don't want to be around for the ammunition turn-in on Friday of the war, because that shit will take till midnight, okay? Because nobody's gonna shoot around, because we're not going to bump into each other, man. We're going to be maneuverous in the mist, and we're not going to hit each other. So we were trying to figure this out. So that's the overall environment. And then stumble into John Kelly, who I'd never met. And I was selected to go to IOC, so I worked for Kelly for a few months, and then behind John Kelly comes John Allen. And we were exposed to, and there, right, Lou Caparata, Jody Osterman, Stacy Clarity, all major generals, lieutenant generals, Paul Kennedy, major general, Dave Furness, major general. We're all lieutenants and captains, like, and our bickering would be a better term. Bickering over these concepts, desperately trying to prove to each other that they don't know shit. I really do. And so we were doing, I don't know how the book, The Enlightened Soldier, which is about somebody who is one of the great, powers of German military education, a guy named Scharnhorst. The book is a great book, right? And I read it. And it talked about, you know, about how they educated instructors. And
right.
So it wasn't anything original to me, but I read it and I walked into John Allen's office when I'm a captain, he's a major. And I said, hey, sir, if I put together a program that would raise the level of instruction at the basic school that would not cost a penny, would you be receptive to the idea? Would you help me walk it across the street? And Major Allen looked at me and said, Mac, you know I would. I said, okay, sir. I think we should start an instructor education program. And so I sat down and I composed the syllabus of it. And back then it was a 2-day program. And it was centered on readings called, one was out of a book called The Teaching of Thinking, by a guy named Nickerson at Harvard. One was called The Craft of Teaching. It was just a book about how to teach. And so,
right.
and it sought to teach people, you can't really do machine guns Socratically, okay?
Right.
Which we struggled with. Guys would try to do machine guns Socratically. And and what happened was the student was getting screwed. Okay, machine guns, it's rote, okay? So we race, we time, we compete, we make it fun, but they learn, right? So we're doing that. So the appropriate vehicle with the appropriate subject matter. Classroom 4, we don't want to beat him up with, what if this, what if that, what if that, because he's going to walk out of the room and think, I don't want to do that again. We want, there needs to be some competitiveness. Take a coin, take a die with you. All right. It's got to be so they can win. And second guessing can't be the only part of it. What we want them to walk out of there thinking is, man, that was really interesting. And and then some days they actually win. And so if all it becomes is a second guessing fest where the enemy's everywhere and the enemy's not everywhere, all right, then we need. But you have to build to that, because if I send Woodbridge in there, I can hear him over there. No, Lieutenant, that's stupid. Well, you know what? Sometimes that's appropriate. It is stupid. But there's got to be this vibrant kind of fun atmosphere around these sand tables and an element of competitiveness that sometimes they're going to win. And when you do that, you create this thirst for knowledge and this positive experience that you then build on. And that's what this was designed to do, all without costing a penny. And so,
right.
So yeah, the father.
It's amazing how inexpensive thinking actually is.
Well, you know what? And
it's so much done that way too.
Oh, and you we increase the baseline instructor and the quality of education across the board without spending a dime, which everybody loved. Which
right.
Everybody loved. So yeah, and then my son went back and he was teaching in it. And I said, you know, son, let me tell you about that thing. He said, easy, Grandpa. I said,
well, you know, I'll tell you something. We are, it's really great to see when good ideas, even if, you know, whether they're you know, cost neutral or not, but good ideas that really up the game, grow roots and become part of the fabric of a school like this. And that I think is clearly evident that's taken place, and it's only gotten better. I mean, as we've sort of refined our tactics, our techniques and procedures, as we've refined our approach to instruction, I think it's become that much better, and it's you know, gone from IOC to the basic course, and it's up to the quality, up the game for all of those student lieutenants.
I got an email for you. Mac, after you get done breaking your arm, patting yourself on the back, ask Woody if the vibrant intellectual atmosphere that those of us who served around 1990 to 1995 experienced in the Marine Corps, is that coming back? I heard you talking about General Gray, who you felt was the greatest commandant in the Marine Corps, because of the spectrum of things that he innovated, from maneuver warfare and enlightenment in the Marine Corps to the gunner program. I'd be curious about Woody's thoughts. Okay, I don't know how you want to tackle that. Give us a grade. You've done this before. Where are we on the intellectual vibrancy of the Marine Corps? And your thoughts on my comment about, I think General Gray is one of the great commandants of the Marine Corps.
Okay, so as far as a grade for intellectual vibrancy, I'm gonna grade on a curve, and I'm gonna go with a letter grade of a C+.
No, let me tell you, that's consistent, because I want to say last time you and I talked about this, you said it was about a C. You know, you said, look, there's the way we can communicate now, and the ease of of participating in the debate, that we had work to do.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I've seen it now improve, you know, over the course of a couple of years, improve slightly, but there's and I'm still really trying to find what the obstacle is, what the impediment is. You know, some of it may be just the fact that people are extraordinarily busy, but I really don't think we're busier than we were. We're not as busy as we were in the certainly in the you know, the first 10 years of the 2000s. We're not as busy as that. I think there's some there's some mental shortcuts going on. Some, you know, people basically towing a party line on some things, and not really doing the intellectual, not being as intellectually curious as they might be, because they don't necessarily have time to do it, and they're also not incentivized to do it. And that's where I think the real issue is. I don't think. Yes, we've got innovation challenges, and we have writing contests and things like that. But I don't think that they're really being encouraged, incentivized the right way to use that intellectual curiosity. And this is a generalization. There are a lot of folks out there doing it exactly the right way, as individuals and as you know, units and commands as well.
How should it be incentivized? Because it used to be a comment when you were published, right? It used to be a comment in Section C back in the day, during this reporting period, published in the Marine Corps Gazette or became a published author, or there was some Section C comment. How should it be? How should participation like that be documented?
So that's there's nothing in the PES manual saying that you can't do that now. There is actually in the order there are some specific justifications for higher marks in the leadership attribute areas, communications in particular, and intellect and wisdom that relate directly to participating in professional discussions, debates, etc. Doesn't talk specifically to getting published, but that's certainly proof that you've got those higher level writing and communication skills.
Hello.
I've gone so far as to for authors that are published, first time authors getting published, for captains and below and gunnery sergeants and below, I write them a letter of appreciation, a formal letter of appreciation that they can have entered into their record, and that
wow.
constitutes commendatory material on their next fitness report.
Well, have you had to do that because of a lack of recognition from commanders? Or from reporting seniors?
I would tell you anecdotally, yes. I mean, I did not come up with the idea personally of writing those letters. The idea to write those letters was prompted by some emails, conversations with junior authors, junior officers, junior Marines who are authors of the articles getting published, and trying to answer their questions.
Yeah.
Can I get something that documents this for my next fitness report or for my record? How do I get this noticed, so to speak?
Right.
And so, easy on my end to prepare those letters and get them out. I know it's had some effect because I've had some other folks complain about not getting published and getting their letters.
All right, where do you stand on?
I dare you
to say General Gray's not a great commandant. Nah, Matt, come on. He was chopped liver.
No, I absolutely.
Go ahead. What do you say? I dare you to.
Yeah. I absolutely wouldn't say that. And as you know, I had the chance to interview the general back as his 90th birthday in June, and published that interview in the June Gazette. Short article, but a long interview. And the general talked about an awful lot of things that he did, not just as commandant, but throughout almost 40 years of time in the Marine Corps. And there's so much that we built on that was the foundation that he laid for us. Deep thinking leader, very well read, and a no nonsense leader as well. But when we look at what we've done since then, how we've evolved into everything from the three block war, the strategic corporal, fixtures of what it is to be a Marine, the reading list. Commandant's Professional Reading Program, all of those intellectual activities to include our warfighting doctrine, maneuver warfare as the warfighting doctrine of the Marine Corps, all of that foundation permitted us to do the things that we've done from, really the mid and late 90s through the present day. The success of our small units, of our company grade officers, our staff NCOs and NCOs, I really think you can trace all of that back to this foundation that General Gray laid for us back in the, you know, back in the late 80s. You know, again, at a time when money was pretty tight, there was a leader who understood the long-term value of thinking as a low-cost investment that pays huge return on investment later on down the road. And so all that thinking and that intellectual vibrancy that he really led from the front and from the top, that got us to a much higher level of play, so that when money became available, number one, we used it smartly. We used it judiciously and invested in other things, more expensive things like equipment and command and control systems and training programs and built on that, when the money was available, again, to produce a really high quality, product, that has been continuously employed now for, you know, over 15 years. So I think that all goes back to General Gray.
All right. You know, we should do a story on, or a segment on, and I'll spring it on you right now, the top five commandants in the history of the Marine Corps and why. I mean, ooh, they do it with presidents all the time, right?
Yep.
And was it Lew Waldt or Barrow that opened the door and said, get out? Who's that? I always screw it up. I always want to say it's Barrow, but I think I always get corrected on it. But it was, you know, mid-70s. And his quote was what, essentially, I don't care if it's me, the sergeant major, and my driver left. We're going to be done with this.
Right.
And so I that would be a little bit of an interesting discussion.
I think that was General Waldt, actually.
Yeah, totally.
I think so. Yeah, because but that was, yeah, I mean, there was throughout the service, a significant drug problem, and associated behavioral problems, and you know, it, we are going, when we say zero tolerance, we mean zero tolerance. You know, it was a shock to the system for a lot of folks. And, but by God, when there's support from the top, to make that sort of a change, you can actually really have an effect, make it work.
Interesting.
But no, that would be an interesting exercise. You know what I'm going to do, because we do similar, what I'll call member and reader participation polls on the Leatherneck platforms on social media fairly frequently. What was your favorite place to be stationed? What was the worst place to be stationed? Those sorts of reader surveys. That top three or top five commandants might be
interesting.
I'd be interested to do. I have a feeling there are a lot of people who are going to vote for the commandants that they served under.
Right. Right.
I
think that General Gray, and even though I served under him, the more I see the way he impacted the institution, the organization, over a long, long period of time, the way what he set in motion, the way it impacted every firefight we got into in terms of our style of command and control. I mean, to me, and then, but that's just one side of it. You know, he created the gunner program, right? All the different things that, you know, and then, you know, he's kind of, as somebody said, he's kind of told me recently, might have been Musselman, I'll lay this on him, he's kind of a Shrek-looking kind of a guy. And then, right? And then he hauls off, and he's this deep thinker. But when you meet him, he blasts you in the chest and knocks you back, not like a foot, but like three steps. Boom! What?
Yep.
Who is this guy? You know, and so he was all of that. And I there's even one more anecdotal story that I throw in. When I talk about him, when in the Battle of Gettysburg Corner, Butch Neal ultimately took the company over, and then they went back to Firebase Carroll, Camp Carroll. And then Butch Neal was flown from Camp Carroll to Dong Ha, which is the headquarters of the 3rd Marine Division. He was brought in to the division commander's office, and he was asked what happened out there. What were you guys doing? When Neal pushed back and said, we didn't want to do what we got ordered to, we pushed back on it and got told to shut up and color, and if you won't do it, we'll send somebody out there that will. We even debated disobeying that, but we didn't. We did exactly what we were supposed to do, which was set in 3 platoon ambushes and don't dig in. And so when then in that part of the discussion, he was then said, okay, we got it. Thank you very much. And that was it. As he's walking through the 3rd Marine Division CP, he gets stopped by a major and says, are you a 3-9? Yes. India Company? Yes. I'm Major Gray. Hey, sir, I'm Lieutenant Neal. Would you sit down on this map with me and tell me exactly what happened? Now, in the midst of all of that, there's a professional. He wanted to know what happened. How did it get screwed up? What did we not understand from here that maybe seemed so apparent to us, and what's going on out there? And that's him, and he's a major, in the division staff. When nobody else cared to stop that lieutenant to ask him what the hell happened. That's a bit of professionalism from Al Gray. So it's very interesting. Very interesting. So anyway. But, I think General Walt, whoa, how do you do that? I think, I don't even know who the commandant was during Korea when we went back down from, a 500,000 to 100,000, and now we had to bounce back up and answer the call in Korea. I that was no small feat. So I think interesting. Ah, there's it. I hope you footnote that.
I will give you credit where it's due.
Thank you.
And share the results, of course.
I think it's awesome. What about, here's an email. Hey, Mac, ask him, what were the most popular duty stations? What is the most hated? So most popular duty station is what?
So if I recall the survey, most popular centered Hawaii, K Bay, and also Marine Forces Europe, Stuttgart, Germany, was greatly loved. And the tie for least popular was 29 Palms and Camp Lejeune.
I hit one of those. Never got to Europe. Your favorite place you ever served? What he was?
Favorite place I ever served? Honestly, it was probably 29 Palms. For what you need to do as an infantryman, that's.
Yep.
From a training perspective, you get spoiled. You truly do by the ability to go out and train in those training areas. In terms of culture or the social aspects, those are kind of non-existent. But yeah, that's not what you're there to do. So.
Yeah, culture.
That was and I love Camp Pendleton.
Culture, you're gonna have to go looking for. I think the largest cultural event now is what? The Walmart in Yucca?
That or the Joshua Tree Rock Festival or something like that.
You know what? Yeah. It comes once a year. You can enjoy all 5 days of it, and then you're back to the Stone Age. Interesting. All right, what else haven't I asked you about this month's Gazette?
Thanks. So with the time remaining, I want to highlight a couple of other things. Really, really fine article in the Leadership and Esprit section by General Mullen, Major General Bill Mullen, mm-hmm. who is the Commanding General of Training and Education Command.
Okay.
Now, he uses a reference to a movie that many folks have seen. movies called Secondhand Lions. Really, really nice film about really about growing up and a lot of character building and leadership aspects to that movie. But there's a scene in it where the character played by Robert Duvall first beats the crap out of a group of punk kids, young teenage guys, and then pulls them aside and gives them the talk on what it takes to be a man. And you never hear what he says to them, but they're all obviously changed and affected by that that talk. And so what General Mullen did is sort of imagine, you know, what he thinks would have been that compelling in a speech on what it takes to be a man. So, you know, the importance of character, of unselfishness, putting the needs of other people first, and those sorts of things. Really, really well done. Thought it was a headliner for the leadership section in November. And then all of the articles in our current operations section are very, very informative. I mean, we talk about everything in there from increases in capability of Russian naval infantry units, some of the ongoing experimentation, the Sea Dragon experiments from Marine Corps Warfighting Lab,
right,
looking at developing future capabilities. But I'm going to highlight one other that's really totally unintentional when you look at the production timeline that we have for publishing the magazine. But on page 79, there's a article on Operation Jumpstart by Major Jonathan E. Morang. And Operation Jumpstart was, this is going to sound very, very familiar. Operation Jumpstart was the deployment between 2006 and 2009 of over 30,000 federally mobilized National Guard soldiers to the south southern border of the United States to support Customs and Border Enforcement. And so, again, eerily familiar to what we're hearing about in the news right now, today, this morning, and certainly what has become a high visibility issue in this election month. But this is a very, very good historical analysis, really, of you know, why Operation Jumpstart occurred, what those state governors required, what the Department of Homeland Security and Customs and Border Enforcement required, and how the military, DOD assets in the form of the Guard and some active duty folks as well, deployed to support that and sustain it over a 3-year period. So good reminder that there really is not a lot new under the sun. And there's always an experience and lessons to be learned from prior deployments, prior engagements.
You know, I have friends that work on the border in various capacity, and they said, you know, when you come down here, it's stunning. It's stunning that this goes on every day. And in fact, I was talking to one last week, and he said, you know, I was down on the border in Imperial County, which is South Central California.
Yep.
And
yep.
He said, you know, two families, you know, ran around a fence and ran right by us. And we were there for 10 minutes. And
mm-hmm.
He said, you know, it's one thing to read about it. It's another thing to see it. And it really is astounding. And then we've had our own little issues down there back in the day when infantry units and other units would be assigned to work for JTF-6, I think it was.
Right. Yes.
And
did,
right.
Did JTF-6 missions back in the '90s.
Back in the '90s. And then I took my company on one. It was great training. And but those ended after an incident in Texas.
Yes, that's correct.
In Texas,
that's correct.
Yeah. And so anyway, so no, as you said, much to learn. All right, Woody, what anything else I haven't asked you that I haven't been smart enough to ask you that you want to tee up for everybody?
No, we're good, and unfortunately I'm running up against a kind of a hard stop, so always great great having a chance to talk with you and your listeners.
All right. Thanks, Woody. Have a good day. Appreciate it. Thanks for buying lunch, too, by the way.
Hey, you bet. You bet. Anytime.
I'll tell you. I love that. I was hoping you'd say that. There you have it. The,
talk to you soon, Matt.
That is the editor and publisher of the Marine Corps Gazette and the publisher of Leatherneck Magazine, Chris Woodbridge. Don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next. On your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. The Gunner will join us, so whatever you do, do not touch that dial. Yeah, the wit and wisdom of Michael Musselman, coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it. The McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Read Board page at allmarineradio.com.
To be fully fit, you have to be physically fit. You also have to be mentally fit.
I wish that more warriors would realize how important it is if you get the psychological support that you need so that you can focus on the rest of your life.
I think it takes strength in order to admit that you have an issue. But it also takes intuitiveness of a friend, a leader, a supervisor to pick up on the signal that the soldier is having issues and needs to seek professional help in dealing with it.
It's also important for the lowest possible levels of leadership to be very supportive in helping their members get the help that they need.
When I went to get help, I had more help than I could ask for from my entire command.
It's sometimes challenging to come to a senior staff member or senior officer in the unit with a problem. There's not a commanding officer out there or a leadership staff out there that doesn't want to help. So don't hesitate. Come ask.
Learn more by visiting www.realwarriors.net or calling 1-866-966-1020.